From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very grateful for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics this week, it's fitting that a weekend that began with Friday the 13th is when we see the political religious rites bacchanal of self-righteousness known as the Values Voter Summit takes place in our nation's capital. The gathering, for the first time ever, heard a sitting U.S. president as its speaker. Also featured on the long list of notorious culture warriors is Kellyanne Conway, Mike Pence, Roy Moore, and many other elected officials, far-right media figures, anti-Muslim organizers Bridget Gabriel and Frank Gaffney, and dozens of others. The year's theme, seizing the moment, of course. We'll have a complete, if painful, recap on next week's show. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Following yesterday's move to allow businesses to opt out of contraception coverage and employee health care plans, the Trump administration is now directing federal agencies to promote what it calls religious liberty, but what critics call discrimination.
Donald Trump built his winning presidential campaign on incessant insults and hollow hyperbole. The biggest, greatest, hugest, best ever, everything that the world has ever seen. I'm not sure about the best part, but there can be no question that the speed and scale of the changes we're enduring truly is unprecedented. Keeping up with it all, the arbitrary assaults on freedom of movement, on environmental policies, on international commitments, on freedom of the press, and on, is a painful and ultimately impossible job. But we've got to keep trying, and we're going to. Earlier this month, the Justice Department unveiled a sweeping and truly unprecedented set of policies that would completely redefine what is meant by religious freedom, by discrimination, and ultimately by civil rights. The reply from a leading organization representing a multi-faith rainbow of traditions, quote, "Not in our name." We'll get details from Interfaith Alliance of Colorado Executive Director Amanda Henderson.
Hello, Charlottesville. We're back. And we have a message.
You will not replace us.
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 You will not replace us! You will not replace us!
Interfaith leaders hiding in fear. Minority clergy escorted to their cars by armed police. A full synagogue stalked by armed white supremacists, even as the city administration is headed by a Jewish mayor. And then, bloodshed in the streets. A peaceful protester dead. A president unable to articulate the distinction between racist hate and desperate opposition. All of this happened in 2017 America, in full view of the nation and the world, just a couple of months ago. Now, Virginia is addressing the awful societal rift exposed by these deadly white supremacist protests in Charlottesville with the new Commonwealth Commission on Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. And, my goodness, do the commissioners have their work cut out for them? Heading up the commission is the Commonwealth Chief Deputy Attorney General, Cynthia Hudson, And I am thrilled to be able to say she is joined in this role by co-chair Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance. And I am very pleased indeed to welcome Cynthia Hudson and Jack Moline to State of Belief Radio. Thank you both for being here.
My pleasure, Welton. Welcome, Cynthia.
Truly my pleasure as well.
No question, most of us were horrified by the events in Charlottesville. But I have to think that for each of you, calling the Commonwealth your home, to see these events unfold must have been a special kind of awful. So can I just ask you to begin by talking about how you've been affected by the resurgent alt-right? Cynthia, would you start, please?
I have been more deeply affected by what was on display in Charlottesville than I can really articulate effectively. And not merely from the perspective of a public servant and the role that I play in government, but on a personal level. I have extolled the virtues of my fellow Americans that ultimately turned into the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and the clear indications that, you know, better angels had prevailed and were going to continue to prevail throughout my lifetime and that of my children and my grandchildren, with the understanding that there are some edges to be polished and some work still to be done, but that most of the threshold issues regarding systemic racism and bigotry and intolerance were behind us. And as I actively participated, quite frankly, in my current role in addressing the issues on the ground in Charlottesville that day, and in the days afterward, as I watched the footage, I was so full that I wasn't sure I could keep my head clear enough to do the actual official duties that I have that are associated with public safety in Virginia. But I'm clear-headed enough in the days since to understand that I'm right where I need to be in order to try and have a voice in this and to perform responsibilities that I hope will move us past this. And it helps me answer a question that I have asked myself since I was old enough to realize the issues that my people, that Black people, have tried to overcome in this country. And that question was, Cynthia, had you been of age and consciousness in the civil rights era, where would you have been? Would you have been on the street? Would you have been marching? Would you have been sitting in? Would you have been acting out? Would you have been heard and active? And now, unfortunately, I have the opportunity to know what I would do because I'm doing it. I'm not only in my official role, but to the extent I can in my personal life, I am trying to give voice and action to support policies and actions that keep this country in the path that I thought it was on, and to resist the forces that are trying to roll back the gains of the civil rights movement.
I've lived most of my adult life in the Commonwealth of Virginia. I've raised three children there. My granddaughter and my soon-to-be next grandbaby are being raised in Virginia. My wife went to the University of Virginia. My daughter Jenny went to the University of Virginia. And I lived in Charlottesville for a year. So though I don't have quite the roots that Cynthia does, Virginia is my home. And more than that, I actually happened to be on vacation on a cruise on the Danube River the week that the events in Charlottesville happened. And as we were processing all of this, one of our ports of call was Nuremberg. And of course, standing in the Zeppelin grounds where Hitler addressed his acolytes, which is now an empty field, but the platform is still there, in the shadow of the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, really had a huge impact on my soul. As Cynthia said, I did not expect that in my lifetime, having enjoyed the protections of the efforts of the Greatest Generation and a series of Republicans and Democrats in the White House who have advanced the cause of national unity and of acceptance of differences. I did not expect that I would be at this point in my life addressing these questions on a personal level and on a public policy level. And yet, here we are.
I'd like to hear each of you give your perspectives on these protests affecting the sense of safety and well-being in the diverse population that calls Virginia home. What's going on in the state right now?
Well, we're kind of really at a crossroads. It's time. Which way are we going to go here? And what is the overall sentiment of Virginians collectively as it pertains to this display of, you know, racial hatred and religious intolerance? And the groups that I encounter in speaking on behalf of the Attorney General's office and substituting for General Herring at speaking events around the state is that most Virginians are appalled at being the focal point of this kind of activity. And one of the things that I note and want to make sure that people know is that many of the people in Charlottesville were not Virginians. Much of that hatred was imported hatred. And unfortunately, the groups who are on the ground there vow to come back again and again and again to Charlottesville. Exactly to what end, I don't think they even know. But the point is, Virginians don't want that here. I believe that is the overwhelming sentiment in Virginia, and I'm glad to know that that's the case. Jack alluded to, I'm a native Virginian, born and raised in Nottoway County, which shares a border with Prince Edward County, whose history with respect to civil rights or lack thereof is legend. Virginia has some responsibility with respect to how this issue of this day gets resolved. We have a checkered history with respect to how we responded to these issues in the past, and I think that Virginians are united more than they're divided with respect to having this play out in a much more positive way and to demonstrate the changes that have occurred since then in this state.
Jack, what's the core mandate? Because as I understand it, the commission goes well beyond just responding to racism and anti-Semitism.
I think that the governor understands and in turn has helped us to understand that this commission is not just about the events that happened in Charlottesville. I agree with Cynthia that the goodwill on the part of most of the citizens of the Commonwealth, no matter where they sit on a continuum of political perspectives, is that they want to live peaceably with their neighbors and that they accept the equality, the inclusion, the equity, all of the things that we are charged to examine. But that it isn't enough for the surface behaviors to reflect an idealized notion of what society is like. So the governor has asked us to look at the laws of the Commonwealth to see what might need to be changed. He's asked us to look at some difficult questions like the namings of streets and public buildings and the presence of monuments in the Commonwealth. He has asked us, and we'll be relying a lot on other researchers, he's asked us to look at the roots of affiliation with terrorist and extremist groups that has afflicted people on the right and on the left in our Commonwealth. All of these things are part of our mandate. We understand from our first meeting that the very first thing we have to do is get a more systemic understanding of the sources of this kind of antagonism in society. And so we're following a double track. One of them is to examine our own relationships and our own understandings, and the other is to look at the facts on the ground. And it's a lot of work, and we don't have much time to do it.
With me are the co-chairs of the Virginia Commonwealth Commission on Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline, and Cynthia Hudson, the Commonwealth of Virginia's Chief Deputy Attorney General. Cynthia, would you talk briefly about the makeup of the commission and what some of those members bring to this critically important work?
Governor McAuliffe and his staff on having pulled together a group of people whose talents and backgrounds and their proven performance in the past certainly promise to bring some of the best thinking in our state to these really, really intractable and difficult issues. It's a roughly 35-member commission, although right now it's still dynamic. There are perhaps some other voices that the governor's office hopes to tap to round out our number. But the commission members include folks who are well-versed in the issues of the immigrant population in Virginia. Hassan Ahmad, in particular, is an immigration attorney and founder of an immigration law firm, member of the Asian Advisory Board, and certainly appreciates having that perspective among the commission members. Rabbi David Asher of Richmond is a member of the commission. We have the education component of these issues represented in Rosa Atkins, superintendent of Charlottesville City Schools, who is an award-winning superintendent in connection with some of the diversity work that she's done in Charlottesville. And of course, her coming from Charlottesville is no accident as it relates to the work of this board and the events that gave rise to it. Ram Bhagat, Dr. Bhagat of Richmond, who's president of the Conciliation Project and founder of the Richmond Youth Peace Project, has been very active in matters of diversity and inclusion for many years. He's among us. I certainly won't list each and every one of the commission members, but there are some others who I'd just like to mention to give you some idea of the range. James Hawden of Blacksburg, because we also have some geographic diversity as well. We're trying to span the state and make sure that voices are heard from all corners. He's a professor of sociology and the director of the Center for Peace Studies and Violence Prevention at Virginia Tech. Sterling Jenright of Fairfax, who has a leadership role in the Fairfax component of the NAACP in that area, is a member of the commission. Again, in the education context, Sarah Gross, president of the Virginia PTA. We were led very ably in our work by Gail Christopher, who recently retired from work at the Kellogg Foundation, where she was instrumental in directing some groundbreaking work in matters of diversity, titled Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation. And I'm excited that Gail is going to bring kind of the model of that work to the work of this commission. And then obviously by not naming all of the other members of the commission, I don't mean at all to diminish what we expect their contribution to be, but it is a truly impressive group of people and growing.
If I can add one or two names to that, I think that sort of gives you a sense of the breadth of the committee. Chief Tanya Chapman is the chief of police in Portsmouth, Virginia. Having the voice of law enforcement is incredibly important to us.
Absolutely.
Chief Ann Richardson is the chief of the Rappahannock Tribe in Virginia, bringing a Native American and indigenous people's perspective. But I think the person who is going to have the hardest job on this commission, even including Cynthia and me, is Kathy Spangler, who is the executive director of the 2019 commemoration of Jamestown. Mm-hmm. And Jamestown is sort of where this whole narrative begins. And she is planning the 300th anniversary of Jamestown, which means that the narrative that we put forward about what it means for Virginia in 2019 is an essential one. It is going to be the measure of the work of this commission. And we're looking to Kathy to help guide us in the kinds of things that we need to address.
The symbolism of the torches, the menacing chants, the naked aggression we see in this alt-white protest, how is this not domestic terrorism, plain and simple?
It is terrorism because its purpose is to strike terror into the hearts of the people who witness it. It is not terrorism because what we have is a group of overgrown fraternity boys walking around with tiki torches And if you just think about that for a little bit, it removes some of the terror from it.
I'm not sure it removes some of the terror from it for those who are directly affected and in its path at the time, though I appreciate absolutely, Jack, the point you're making. If you reduce it to its reality, then you're right, that takes some of the terror aspect out of it. I can tell you that in working with various groups in my official capacity, we're looking at this issue of domestic terrorism as from the purely legal perspective. It would be remiss of me to speak about exactly what shape that's taking at this point, but I'll leave it here and simply say you have a point.
Would you describe what success would look like for you? And what I mean is a year or two down the road, how would things have to look for you to feel like you've been effective in this work?
For me personally, to feel as though I've been effective, at least in terms of what I can effectively bring to the work of this commission, it will be that institutionalized policies that promote differences among us or that have even unintended disparate impacts on currently disaffected groups have been identified, and ways to eliminate them have at least been cataloged with a clear path toward how they might be achieved. And just in practical terms, I think we would be hugely, hugely effective if somebody has taken a big look at the Virginia Code, the Virginia Administrative Code, and any other codified public policy and tried to make sure that the government, even inadvertently, doesn't have policies instituted in law that contribute to differences among people in ways that hurt them and that contribute to this narrative of differences in value among people.
I agree with everything that my co-chair has said. I think that the Commonwealth government needs to go on record as doing everything it can to make every citizen of the Commonwealth feel that they have equal protection under the law. But from a faith perspective, I would say if we can make some progress to where people will hear the voice of the prophet saying, each person should be able to sit beneath vine and fig tree and none will make him or her afraid. If they can hear that as something that's achievable rather than a pipe dream, I'd be a very happy guy.
We're going to get to talk some more with Rabbi Jack Moline after Cynthia's off. Cynthia Hudson is the Commonwealth of Virginia's Chief Deputy Attorney General. She's also co-chair of the new Commonwealth Commission on Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Cynthia, I really appreciate you taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio, and we want to wish you success in this critically important work.
Thank you, Reverend. I appreciate just as much the opportunity that you gave me to speak to these issues.
I'll talk more with Cynthia Hudson's co-chair, Rabbi Jack Moline, in just a few minutes. And later, Interfaith Alliance of Colorado Executive Director, the Reverend Amanda Henderson. Now, if you miss any part of today's show, you can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website. You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows, all of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. Talk about Interfaith Alliance and its role both nationally and at the state level to challenge the level of racism, anti-Semitism, and homophobia that we're seeing in this country right now.
One of the most important things that I have to do, Welton, is to reach out to people who have all sorts of different perspectives on the challenges we face as a society. I think that everybody who was in the room where the commission met this past week understood that we have a variety of communities who would not be at the table, to whom we nonetheless must reach out, because you can't legislate tolerance. It has to enter into the hearts and minds of the people who are going to practice it. And that is the goal of Interfaith Alliance. We have always defended people, no matter their religion or their their lack of a faith community to identify with. We've defended them regardless of their sexual orientation, and that includes people who are heterosexual, because we all have the same rights under the Constitution, and we're all created out of the same genetic material, and for those of us of faith, out of the same spiritual material. So that's what this is all about. This is why my work in Interfaith Alliance is perfectly suited for my volunteer work now with the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Jack, do you see a component of religious rhetoric helping to legitimize these biases among certain people? And if so, how can we oppose that kind of thinking?
You know, this sort of gets to the heart of the question of the Justice Department's estimation of the First Amendment. The First Amendment protects your conscience, my conscience, the conscience of every citizen of the United States. But the Constitution as a whole protects the rights of every citizen of the United States. And conscience does not trump law in this country. There is a history of civil disobedience if you disagree, but then you deal with the consequences. You don't insist that you're exempt from the enforcement of what everybody else's rights and privileges are. And that, I think, is something essential that we have to offer as Interfaith Alliance, and that faith communities, no matter where they sit on a continuum of fundamentalism or liberalism, where no matter where they sit in terms of Western or Eastern traditions, all religious traditions have to come to terms with the fact that in these United States, and it should only happen around the world, but in these United States, no religion is dominant, and religion itself is not dominant. It is the law of the land, the Constitution.
Earlier, you mentioned local interfaith alliances. In just a little bit, I'll be talking to Amanda Henderson of Interfaith Alliance of Colorado about the terrible so-called religious freedom policies the administration has recently unveiled that you have just alluded to. But there's also the completely separate, yet just as harmful, demolition of the contraceptive mandate that we've just seen happen. Would you talk a little bit about that, please?
You know, it's pretty remarkable that for all of the criticism that was leveled against what was depicted as the unilateral actions of the president in the last administration, we now have a president who is doing just the opposite, and to the detriment of citizens rather than the benefit of them. No one in this country should be forced to take contraceptives. No one should be forced to undergo any kind of medical procedure that violates their religious beliefs if it isn't for the purpose of saving their life in an emergency. And yet, what has happened with these guidelines that have been issued from the White House and what is about to happen with these guidelines from the Justice Department is that a particular religious perspective, one that is identified with a small minority of people in this country, that will make their numbers sound like they're a lot, but they're a small minority in this country, are imposing their religious perspective on people who are only trying to take advantage of the legal protections that are theirs under the Constitution and the Code of the United States.
So what's the role of interreligious leaders and activists on this one? Because it's what the Catholic bishops have long demanded, and what many evangelical Christians have suddenly realized is what they also have deeply held beliefs about. What is the interreligious community and its leaders? What's their role? What's their response need to be on this?
I think that anybody who is going to affirm that they believe in a pluralistic society in which the rights of human beings are acknowledged universally has to be able to make a distinction between their own deeply held beliefs, which should govern their lives and the lives of those who adhere to a particular philosophy or religious tradition, and what is legal and appropriate for the United States. With deep respect to my Roman Catholic and evangelical colleagues, if they are legislating or if they're attempting to see legislated the rights and privileges of Americans who do not share those beliefs, then they are making the statement, and we've heard it directly from some individuals, including some candidates for office. They're making the case that their understanding of the law of God supersedes our common understanding of the protections of the Constitution. And that may be a lot of things, Welton, but it is not America.
Is there a way to work across denominational lines when religion has become so profoundly hijacked in the service of culture war political agendas?
The answer to that question is yes. Without going into the details of a specific example, I will give you one nonetheless. I've recently made the acquaintance and developed a very unlikely friendship with someone whose values religiously are the polar opposite of mine, or so I thought until we started to talk. Our common respect for life, our common respect for the role of love in sustaining a human life and a spiritual life, our common belief in the importance of a faith life that puts an individual in right relationship with God or the world as they view it, has given us an opportunity to dialogue in a way I never thought was possible. And my friend would say the same thing, I have to tell you. I think we will see the fruits of this relationship. It came together quite a while ago, but we each were the first people we reached out to after the tragedy in Las Vegas, because both of us share a concern for the victims of gun violence in this country. And we're of the belief that because we come from two very different directions, our voice collectively with others would have a little more impact.
Jack, please talk about the most urgent work Interfaith Alliance is doing right now and how critically important it is that every one of our listeners become members of the Interfaith Alliance if they aren't already.
So, well, I'm going to say that the critical work of Interfaith Alliance is the same critical work it's been doing, only more so. Our protection of the rights of LGBTQ Americans, our belief that religious discrimination, especially against religious minorities, and most especially against the Muslim American community, is of critical importance. Our belief that people should be allowed the protections of the First Amendment without it being weaponized to disadvantage them. And critically, and because we are the ones raising our voices most strongly on this, the protection of the Johnson Amendment, keeping money for electioneering out of 501c3s and particularly religious institutions, those remain our big issues. But the most critical issue for our listeners, and folks, listen carefully to me, please, is not to be distracted by the nonsense that's coming out of the White House. It is a great temptation to go running after someone who makes outrageous statements in social media or who shoots paper towels like basketballs and try to make this a referendum on a man's personality. We are focused diligently and passionately on the issues of religious freedom that are the mission of Interfaith Alliance, and only by the support, the membership, the contributions of people like our listeners are we going to be able to continue this work, which will have a much longer-term impact on religious rights and freedoms than the contents of a Twitter account.
Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, defending true religious freedom. Jack has also just been appointed co-chair of the Virginia Commonwealth Commission on Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. Jack, it's such an important issue, and it's tearing at the fabric of our republic. I am so pleased that you're in the role that you're in addressing this crisis along with so many other roles that you carry. Thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
And Welton, we are very proud to be able to keep your voice on the air, a voice for all of these values that we share. And might I add, I'm also very proud of the Chicago Cubs. Have a really good weekend. We're all Cubs fans now.
The Trump Justice Department made a sweeping and unprecedented policy change that at bottom reprioritized anti-discrimination policies government-wide. Interfaith Alliance of Colorado, for one, responded with the inspiring Not in Our Name campaign. And I am happy to welcome Executive Director, the Reverend Amanda Henderson, back to State of Belief Radio. Amanda, thank you for being with us again.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Why was it important for Interfaith Alliance of Colorado to respond so quickly and resolutely to the administration's position change on religious liberty and protections for women and LGBT persons?
You know, I think this is a very clear issue in a time when there are so many things that are complex and nuanced. This is one that is just clear. As people from multiple faith traditions, we are called to be welcoming and to love our neighbor. This is at the heart of so many of our different traditions. So it's disheartening when political people and leaders use our faith traditions as a justification to do exactly the opposite, to cause harm and to discriminate against people. And that's just not who I am as a religious leader or who the people that I know as religious people and communities are. I think that I want to live in a community where I or the people that I know and care for, or all people, should have the freedom to walk into a public place of business and to be treated the same way as anyone else, that we shouldn't be treated differently by who we are or what we believe or the color of our skin. And this is something that I feel like we decided decades ago as a country, and I don't understand why we continue to come back to this. First and foremost, I think that the timing was disheartening in a time when our country was in the midst of grieving. We've been crying out over these national disasters, and this week, fires, and so many are hurting. We had just had the mass shooting in Las Vegas, and people are reeling and in pain. And in the midst of this, there is this work happening behind the scenes to take away freedom from people, to limit opportunity and access to things like birth control, that as a woman, that gives me greater freedom and ability to determine the direction of my life, to limit people who are gay and lesbian and transgender from experiencing freedom to walk and be themselves in the communities that they live in. I think that it's our job as religious people to call this out and to stand with those who are being harmed, and to shine a light during this time when there are so many things happening on this underground work that is taking away people's freedom and rights and opportunity. So it's important for us to be gathering religious people and to speaking with a prophetic voice of love and to calling out these laws and policies that are causing harm.
Amanda, how harmful is it to authentic religion to encourage bias and a false victim mentality?
I think it's extremely harmful, especially in a time when so many are disillusioned with organized religion, and so many people have written us off as hypocrites and people who are more concerned with nitpicking about morality and discriminating against those they disagree with, that this just perpetuates those stereotypes. And my experiences and the statistics show that the vast majority of people who come from multiple religious traditions are working to live their faith and to love in their community in ways that are full of compassion and love and generosity. And so using our name as religious people just perpetuates these harmful stereotypes, and it really does damage to our way of being as people of faith living in the community.
Are you seeing a broader pushback among faith leaders and other people of faith in Colorado and beyond?
That's a good question. I absolutely am. I'm a part of different rabbi and clergy group this week. We all talked about the ways that we are confronting this in our community and the ways that we are daily coming together to speak a different vision of who we are and to act as a different vision of who we are. that is my place of hope in this time, is seeing the ways that so many people are coming together across our differences to say, this is not who we are. This is not who we want to be. And there is a level of resilience and determination, while I think that too often that's not being seen because it's happening behind the scenes, that people are being strengthened and coming together to act and move for love and compassion.
Do you worry that even more attacks on previously protected groups of our fellow Americans may be on the way?
Absolutely. And I don't think it's even a worry that they're about to come. I think that the numbers over the past year show that they have been coming. We work closely here with the Department of Justice and Homeland Security, and we have a coalition of groups who are standing up against hate, and we've been tracking, and there is an absolute increase in acts of hate and aggression and violence against marginalized people. And this gets pushed down by some of our leaders questioning the facts, but the statistics are there that there has been an increase. And I do feel concern that this will continue to increase with the current political climate.
Amanda, I also want to highlight the upcoming celebration that Interfaith Alliance of Colorado is hosting. The Force for Good campaign is ongoing, but later this month, you've got the Force for Good Awards coming up. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah, we are really excited about this because one of the things that we feel is so important is to be a catalyst for social change. And that involves encouraging and highlighting and supporting those who are using their faith as a force for good in the community. So we will be celebrating a few specific people and groups. The first is Bishop Karen Olavito of the Methodist Church, who is the first openly gay woman to hold the role of bishop in the United Methodist Church. And we're giving this award to her as well as to the Mountain Sky area of the church, who has done a beautiful job and set an example of how to stand in difficult spaces with love and compassion while continuing to be on the side of justice and equality. And to do that without harming others, but really holding that space grounded in love. We will also be giving an award to Denver Homeless Out Loud, who is one of our partners here who works on the street and is always centering the experience of people who are experiencing homelessness. And we've worked together with them to build a coalition to show an alternative way of thinking about addressing homelessness through creating a tiny home village that's grounded in self-determination and community. So we'll be highlighting their work and the things that they have taught us. And their faith is not always spoken in the same ways that mine is, but it is one of the most authentic. They are some of the most authentic people I have ever been around. And so we're excited to honor them. And then finally, we will be honoring one of our legislators, Representative Joe Salazar, who last year brought a bill to the Colorado legislature to name that Colorado would not participate in any sort of list of keeping track of our Muslim community or any type of internment camp that has been used in the past, and which Colorado both participated in with Japanese internment camps, sadly, in our history, and our governor at the time spoke out against those. So Joe Salazar has really led the way to stand with our refugees and our immigrants and our religious minorities. So by highlighting these stories and these people in this time when it feels like all we hear is bad news, we hope that people will continue to be inspired and continue to stick with being a force for good in the community.
Those great choices. How do people in the area get more information on going to this event?
So if you go to our Facebook page, we have a very active Facebook page. You can look us up at Interfaith Alliance of Colorado. You can also go to our website at interfaithalliance.org co.org and get more information.
The Force for Good campaign is such an inspiring initiative. Would you just talk just a little more about that?
Yeah, you know, it started as us wanting to build a foundation of people who were ready to act and to speak out as we have seen this rise of using freedom of religion as a justification for discrimination. We got out front and named, we are building a base of people who are going to speak out when religion is used to harm and to continue to highlight religion as a force for good in our communities. So we have people who are signed on from faith communities, as well as businesses and nonprofits and individuals, as well as organizations. And because of this, in Colorado, at our state legislature, for the past 3 years, we've been able to stop any sort of bill that's using religious freedom as a justification for discrimination. And that's another piece of this Masterpiece Cake case that's important, is that in Colorado, we have said that this is not okay three times in the state legislature, as well as in the Colorado Supreme Court that refused to pick up this case, and in our civil rights division. So it's disturbing that the Supreme Court, you know, if they were to side against side with Masterpiece Cake and against the couple who experienced discrimination, they would also be siding against the will of the people in Colorado, who have multiple times said that this is not okay.
By the way, are you available to be Attorney General of the United States?
I'm not sure they would take me.
I'm pretty sure they wouldn't. The Reverend Amanda Henderson is Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance of Colorado. The Force for Good Awards ceremony will be on Monday, October 23rd in Denver. You can get tickets and learn more about the organization at interfaithallianceco.org. Amanda, it's always great to talk with you. You're doing a good job. Keep up the good work, and thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you and promise you we will handle that money responsibly for the betterment of communicating what's going on in our nation, and we'll try to do it in a civil way. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.